Well, I mean, it seems to me that complete and perfect enlightenment is I mean, I don't know. I mean, Ajahn Chah, who was a teacher in the forest tradition in Thailand, he had said something like, people who became monks or who are living the monastic life at his place, it would sort of be understandable, it would be very doable for somebody to be there for a year and achieve sotapanna. That somebody throwing themselves into practice and living the full monastic life there, it would be reasonable to understand that they could achieve sotapanna in a year. I think that's very reasonable. As to complete and perfect enlightenment as the fourth stage of awakening, you might want to just, look at, the 10 fetters and see what it means to break them all, or contemplate what it would mean to dissolve all 10 fetters. I always think there's a problem with goal orientation, just because it's such an on and off thing. And complete and perfect enlightenment, I think, is a really big deal. Meaning there are Tibetan lamas who are pretty achieved, but they're not arhats. Absolutely. Stream entry is doable. I think it requires, I mean, I don't, what do I know? Only my teacher would know whatever I've achieved, which I couldn't even know myself, actually. But it seems that what's required in meditation is the willingness to really surrender to mindfulness, to really surrender the mind's desire, grasping the desire to be thinking, and to make, to make a narrative in the mind, thinking about this and that and the other thing. That desire, that the restlessness that leads to making a storyline in the mind, thinking about my past, thinking about my future, thinking about my feelings, thinking about how I'm thinking about my psychology, my emotional process. Thinking about all of that has to be dropped and surrendered to mindfulness, which means simply watching, meaning that the light has to be turned higher, or the intensity of mindfulness has, I would think, in my experience, has to be dialed up, so that, for as an example, I want to be, or I commit myself to be aware of the sensory experience, or the full body self experience of every portion of every breath, of the beginning, the middle, the end of every breath, and the pause, and the beginning, and the middle, and the end of every exhalation, and the pause. And it doesn't have to be that one is thinking beginning, middle, end, but there's a sense of I'm committed to being present in watching and feeling and aware, which is mindfulness, of the whole breath from beginning through middle to end. The whole inhalation and the whole period of the pause and the whole cycle of the exhalation. And so then one needs a tighter focus, or starting with a tighter focus, meaning I'm going to focus only in the head, in the nose, only in the nose tip or the nostrils sensation zone. And I don't care about my thinking, and I don't care about my feeling, and I don't care about the pain in my body, and I don't care about the problems in my life. I don't care about myself. I only care about being present for the sensation of every portion of each inhalation and each exhalation. Yeah, what's happening there, I think, is the mind is not fashioning differentiation. When mindfulness is very strong, it means that thoughts are not arising. It means that one can be, like what Ross said in terms of silence of mind at a steady state. holding the mind, be capable of silence of mind at a steady state, which means stabilized non-production of thinking, which means a clear mind, but a clear mind that lasts for a long time. And that's the only mind, or the only way that mind could perceive and be mindful of every phase of every inhalation and every exhalation. I want to be, you know, to be able to sit for an hour and be aware of every inhalation and every exhalation is the first goal, I think, the way I set it for myself. Every single inhalation, I want to be present to watch and be mindful of, which really just means be aware of that which requires non-thinking. Aware, you know, thinking means I'm aware of thinking, or the attention is focused on thinking, because there's production of thinking. That's where attention goes. And mindfulness is not that. Mindfulness is pure awareness, or non-productive awareness, awareness without the production of thinking. That's the only way one could be present or mindful of every single exhalation, every single inhalation and exhalation of the whole period of sitting. And that is a state, that's ultimately a state of non-differentiation, or the mind's experience becomes increasingly non-differentiated. You're not differentiating between this is my skin and that is the floor, this is the border and that is the external field. That those differentiations of thought don't arise. And that's, you know, that's moving towards unity, a sense that, oh, okay, this is not, I can experience this body and its sensations and the floor and the external field, but that's actually, that experience is generated by thinking, by perception and conception. And when mindfulness is very strong, those differentiations don't happen. So one moves into non-differentiated, naked or non-grasping awareness, and that's mindfulness. And that takes guts. It actually takes a willingness to die. The dying is not, I'm not, my body's going to fall over. It's the dying of the sense of self that comes with continual differentiation of this and that. Subject, not, that's ahamkara. You know, ahamkara or self-making, I-making, or eighth fetter, conceit, self-conceit. Is subjectivity, or dual consciousness, or me and you, or this and that. All that differentiation of this and that needs to fall away, or will fall away, when mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. And the commitment, like what you experienced, when mindfulness is strong, and the mind is really quiet, which is samadhi, or, you know, calm abiding, but it's really non-production of thoughts and bright awareness. When that's happening, you can't tell the difference between, you know, where the floor touches the body and the body starts. Even these thoughts of floor and skin and body and me and you, or me and that, those, that doesn't even arise. And that's a taste of unity, or non-dual awareness. Well, there is fear associated with prolonged non-fashioning. I'm talking about, you see, when you're discussing the experience of non-differentiation, you're fashioning emptiness. You're fashioning, or the mind is conceiving non-differentiation. Right? There's the normal dual consciousness experience. I am sitting here, my butt, my skin is on the floor, or, you know, I'm sitting on the floor, and I'm having sensations in my leg, which is different than the floor that I can feel under my leg. That's the normal dualistic consciousness view. Then to say, oh, I'm not having that, I don't know where my skin starts or ends, or the floor ends and my skin starts, this is also fashioning. You're fashioning the mental conception of non-differentiation. It's further fashioning to describe an experience of non-differentiation. Okay? It's all naming activity. And so I'm talking about not knowing that you're not knowing, experiencing not knowing or non-fashioning, and then admitting or surrendering to the unknowability of true non-differentiation, which means I don't even know what the fuck's going on here. Am I in mindfulness? I don't know. It struck me many years ago, the only way one could be in mindfulness or in true mindfulness, one could not be conceiving the experience that I am now in true mindfulness. True mindfulness doesn't allow the conceiving or the thought, I'm now in true mindfulness. One could be there, but not know that one is there. One cannot, because knowing is differentiating, you see. Knowing is naming activity. Knowing is conceiving. Whether you're knowing of me and you, or my skin and the floor, or, oh, the skin and the floor are one, or, oh, this is an experience of unity, all of that's still conceiving, actually. And to really be out of that is no man's land. Right. So all the conceiving of your experience of non-differentiation is further differentiation. And I'm saying to recognize that and then drop that and go back to the breath, because that's all we're talking about, is just go back to the breath, which means every phase of each inhalation and every phase of each exhalation, and letting the body do what it wants in terms of the breathing, which means sometimes the breath will be fast and I don't like it. The breath will be shallow and I don't like it. The exhalation will get long. You know, the exhalation will get longer, and I feel like I may never breathe in again. That happens, but that's okay, and I'll just let it be. And I don't know when I'll breathe. Or the nose gets very funky, and then my face, you know, there's a contraction of certain musculature around the nose and the upper lip and the mouth, because there are blockages in the lower chakras that are associated with micromuscular contractions from the mouth through the upper lip to the nose. Okay? And I'm not going to do anything about it because I don't even know what it is. But it's arising, so I'm not going to interrupt it. And if some teacher came over and looked at me, they'd think I look like, you know, like a goof or a goon or an animal. But that's what the face seems to want to do. But okay, I know that that's part of some kind of releasing process, and I'm not going to do anything about it. But I'll keep watching the breath. And so this is a very, I call it a fierce non-doing or fierce non-attachment. Because in my experience, there has to be a certain bravery to experience continued non-differentiation and allow the body's strange processes to continue arising and let them be as long as they want, meaning strange facial expressions around the mouth and the upper lip and the nose. That are associated with the release of long-term micromuscular contraction in the face, associated, of course, with second, third chakra. I mean, terrible itchiness around the borders of the nose, meaning where the nose hits the skin. What's that? Well, it's something about sinus, you know, long-term sinus muscular contraction or blockage associated with third chakra, obviously. Long-term third chakra blockages for me. So, and that thinking about it doesn't help. Surrendering to letting it continue as long as it wishes to continue is the only way. And surrendering to unknowability. the more I can be comfortable without naming activity, the faster the process will go. That's what I'm talking about. And that kind of surrendering to unknowability generates fear, because the mind is out of its element. One is leaving the realm of mind, and or mind is becoming unimportant. Mind as a tool, mind not as the sense of self. The sense of selfhood is disengaging from mind. Yes. If you look at the four stages of attainment, right, here I'll just send you a Wikipedia link. This is the four stages of awakening in Buddhism. And I would never, the Sotapanna is the first, called stream entry. Once returner is the second stage, non-returner is the third stage, and arhat is the fourth and final stage. The second and third stages, which is called once returner and non-returner, are not fundamentally, they're basically developments, they're deepened freedom, or increased freedom of the first stage, Sotapanna. So it says here, stream enterer Sotapanna is free from identity view, attachment to rites and rituals, and doubt about teachings. That's a very clean way of writing it. Basically, if you want to understand once returner and non-returner, you have to also understand the stage before it, which is Sotapanna. So Sotapanna means, we did this already, you know, free from belief in any views of self, meaning I am my body, I am not my body, I am this and I am that. It's basically an understanding that all views about the essential self are limited, are mistaken, are incomplete, are not quite right. That the true self is not expressible in any view. What we are, as a being or not a being, as a self or a not self, whatever it is, can't be expressed in any view. And then there's attachment to rites and rituals, which is just, you know, thinking that performance of certain activity with body and mind and speech, you know, is the same as awakening or definitely makes awakening in a, you know, mechanical way. That body, mind, or particularly body, speech, ritual, or performance of activity is awakening or leads for sure to awakening or is the, you know, a 1, 2, 3 stages that create awakening or something, that they're quite distinct, knowing that they're different. And then doubt about the teachings of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or Buddha's attainment and the value of, or truth of the teaching, and then the value of community. Once returner and non-returner have those achievements or have those freedoms, and they are progressively more free of both desire and aversion. And that's basically the result of very, very subtle cutting of the roots of desire and aversion, which means an increasing fourth and fifth chakra activation, or increasing freedom from first, second, third chakra blockage, both, which comes naturally as the person more and more first sees that all desire and all aversion doesn't help, that it's not helpful to me in the long run, or it's not essentially even helpful to me now to desire and get or to hate. The sense of value, they become devalued. There's a very subtle devaluation in the mind of that person. First, there's a devaluation of attachment to grasping, you know, desire and aversion, where they realize these are unhelpful ever, always. And then there's a realization, you know, that these are forms of restlessness. And when the mind is increasingly still and spacious, eventually they don't even arise. Meaning, something happens and the person doesn't generate desire or doesn't generate ill will. You know, the person in a group, somebody shouts at them and says, "Fuck you." And previously, before, the person would have been totally reactive and said, "How dare you," or "Come on, let's go outside and punch it out." ill will, which is, you know, desire, desire for that conflict. So that's desire and ill will together, as always. They don't even arise. It's like you throw a rock into a cloud, and it just goes right through, or it dissolves. The person doesn't even have the bases anymore for those reactions, for those two reactivities, for the reactivity of yes, I want it, or no, get it away. I'm not sure if that explains it, but they're basically very subtle. It's the difference between second and third, once returner, non-returner. The reason that they don't return, of course, is that they don't have the mind basis for returning. You can say that, you know, the purpose of third density is to learn the ways of love. You can say that the non-returner has learned the ways of love sufficiently to no longer need to return to third density. What that really means in practice is there's been so much clearance of blockage in the first three the lower triad, first three chakras. There's been so much clearance of the lower triad, three blockage, three chakras, and so much development of fourth and fifth, which is the ways of love, right? Fourth and fifth chakra are both love related when they're put together. So much so that there would simply be no value. They can return, you know, they pass the lessons of third density incarnation. But it's hard to say that a stream enterer would necessarily not be harvestable. So putting these two views together, Ra and Gautama's system, is a little difficult. It would seem to me that the stream enterer would be harvestable, and everybody, all the other stages, obviously, also. So it would seem to me that even the stream enterer is a non-returner, in the sense that they don't have to incarnate here, but there is some value. Then we get very esoteric, because there is some value to 3D space-time as the platform for achieving the final stage, Arahan. Meaning some entities that are like sixth density, right? Some of the people around Gautama, I'm sure they were sixth density wanderers, but they came here into 3D space-time for the teaching, to be next to the Buddha and get the teachings and then be capable of leaving sixth density or seven by their work here in that incarnation, rather than stay in sixth density for that. I don't know if that explains it. Maybe. You see, the difference between stream enterer and once returner and non-returner, Sakadagami and Anagami, Anagami. Gami means returner. Ana means once. And Sakada means once, and Ana means not. Sorry. So once coming back and not coming back. The difference is the degree to which they have cut out the roots which give rise to desire and ill will, or desire and aversion. Sensual desire actually is associated with love of body and body sensation. And the love, you know, what kind of love or attachment of body to body and body, you know, we're talking about 3D body and body, 3D body sensations as the fetters that once returner and non-returner have broken more than stream enterer. Now, how does that look in sixth density in terms of consciousness levels of development, consciousness, where there is no 3D body in play? Well, I think that we're talking about restlessness, a restlessness of yin and yang, the ninth fetter restlessness. So the what is, you know, desire is grasping, sensual desire, whether it's body or any, is a kind of thrusting forward and or opening to take or wanting to take, and ill will is a pushing away. But I'm just saying that these tendencies of mind would be more harmonized for upper sixth density beings than for lower sixth density beings, or beings whose achievement is like 6.6 or 6.7, would have less of this type of polarized restlessness of energy and consciousness than those at earlier stages of sixth density. And maybe, yes, as you're saying, those at earlier stages of sixth density consciousness with greater, a little bit greater restlessness associated with grasping and aversion, or pulling in and pushing away, or thrusting forward versus reception. Those with more of that restlessness activity occurring would be more likely to wander than those with less. That's probably so. Meaning, a being who's 6.7, their consciousness in sixth density, they're an old wanderer, you know, a late sixth density wanderer versus an early sixth density wanderer. The late sixth density wanderer, yeah, is preparing for harvest into seven. They're not wandering. While the early sixth density wanderer, who, you know, I don't think they have lust for human body or human sensation. The late sixth density, you know, a late sixth density wanderer, sure, would less likely be wandering. An early sixth density wanderer would be a little further from harvest to seventh density, and so would be more likely to wander. And the early sixth density wanderer, not that they would have more ill will and desire, but they would have more restlessness between love and wisdom. They would more have less balance between the polarized qualities of mind function that are associated with desire and aversion, or thrusting forward and reception. What is yin and yang, right? Moving, reaching and being and waiting for the reaching. Moving forward and stillness receiving the other moving forward to one. What is, you know, those are yin and yang. So desire is opening to receive, or longing to take and push in, take in, and ill will is the force to thrust forward and push away. Something like that. So those tendencies of mind would be in less harmony in early 60, which would be more associated with wandering, while in late 60, those two qualities of energy consciousness would be more harmonized, more balanced, less restless, and the likely, you know, that they would be less likely to be wandering. So that fits. So this, yes, the phrase craving for fine material existence is basically attachment to the Rupa Loka. Okay? There's Kama Loka, Rupa Loka, Arupa Loka. There's the three worlds in Buddhism. This is what I'm these terms. Kama means desire, loka means world or realm. Desire world or physical, you know, in my understanding, third density. Then you've got Rupa Loka, which means Rupa means form, loka world or realm, the form realms. Then you've got Arupa Loka, which is formless realms, or Arupa, not Rupa, loka or bhumi, realms or worlds. So that's formless worlds, formless realm. So desire world, or desire world, which is 3D in my understanding, form worlds with their fourth and fifth density, fine material, same as fine material. And then you have formless realms, which is sixth and seventh density, all light, or unity, you know, the self, the logoic, etheric field of sixth density is basically coming to understand that the basis of the seven densities, intelligent energy, that is the self, which is the body of unity, also called etheric body, or the logoic etheric body. the cosmic sixth density energy field, or the octave sixth density energy field, is known as the self, which is unity. Okay, so that's formless because it's all the forms, all differentiated forms come out of intelligent energy, and in sixth density, Atman, higher self, which is formless realm, knows that all that is differentiated is a differentiation of intelligent energy, and that's the only true form or energy or quality of creation, which is the basis of the seven dimensions, and that's what I am. That's unified self. Self is the one energy field, or the one light that differentiates. The one light of God, or the one light of the Logos, or intelligent energy, light, love, love, light. That which differentiates into all forms, that's the only true substance, or the only true reality. That's then known as the self. That's sixth density. That's formless realm. So, then, you have these three levels. Third density, which I'm equating to Kamaloka, or Kama Sugati Bhumi, meaning the desire realm. This fits into the discussion of Dana Sutta, which we started last time. So, in my limited understanding, Kamaloka, desire realm, Kama Sugati Bhumi, meaning desire, happiness of desire, sensuous desire, realms, is third density. Physical and non-physical, meaning astral and physical time, space-time. Rupaloka is form realms, fourth and fifth density, and Arupaloka, or formless realm, sixth and seventh density, spirit complex, head chakras. So then, the translation that you gave here, that she provided here, is a better translation than the one that I found, which was not the right page, but that's what it is. Craving for fine material existence means attachment to the form realms. It means attachment to love and attachment to wisdom. Attachment to fourth density consciousness, attachment to fifth density consciousness. Attachment to states of mind or qualities of mind associated with fourth and fifth chakra. Attachment to fourth and fifth chakra activity. Okay? Is the craving for fine material existence that is cut out only by Arahant. Then, craving for existence on the level of formlessness, see, everybody, you gotta work with everybody's crazy translation. That is attachment to formless existence. To say that, you see, it's very interesting with the four stages of awakening. The only one that actually is really, really free is the Arahant. And the once-returner and the non-returner, second and third stages of awakening, still have desire for incarnation in fourth and fifth density. Now, Buddhists would never say that. They would say they still have craving for fine material existence. It's craving for form. It means craving for rupaloka and craving for arupaloka. And the basis for, and again, if I'm making the equation in chakras in a simplistic way, that form realms, fourth and fifth density, are associated with fourth and fifth chakras, then passion for form, which is also a shitty translation, because it's not really passion, it's attachment. It's grasping, attachment or grasping. Attachment is probably fine. Attachment to fourth and fifth chakra activity. Right? There's no problem with activity. The problem is attachment to activity. You know? Like the saying, money is the root of all evil. No. It's love of money is the root of all evil. Attachment to money is a big problem. It's not actually the only root of evil, but they didn't see things. They didn't see the more evil levels of desire when they wrote that. But it's attachment to form realms, which means attachment to I think, fourth and fifth chakras activity. Passion for what is formless means attachment or grasping of sixth and seventh chakra activity. Sixth and seventh density incarnation, or the desire for nothingness, the desire for the higher jhanas, the formless jhanas. So then you get an understanding of the jhanas, the eight trances, and the four stages of awakening, and the ten fetters, and the seven dimensions, and the seven chakras or states of consciousness. Okay? How about that? Then, what you found is, what I find is, the sixth and seventh fetters become attachment to fourth and fifth and then sixth and seventh chakra activity, attachment to samskara, and attachment to the dissolution of samskara. Samskara, meaning fashioning, fourth skanda, is basically creating, you see, form, fourth and fifth chakra activity. What is fourth and fifth chakra activity, right? What is love? What is wisdom? They're basically the fashioning of fine material states of consciousness. The fashioning or their fashionings of consciousness and fashionings of samskara. Moldings of conceiving. Moldings of conscious atmosphere, consciousness, the mind atmosphere. The mind atmosphere is reception. The mind atmosphere, the mind space is reflection. Reception, fourth chakra. Reflection, fifth chakra. Okay? So, chittakash, as Nityananda says, chitta, like sat-chit ananda. Chit meaning mind. One way of, you know, crude translation of chit or chida, chit, Sanskrit, meaning mind or mind field. Akash is like Akashic record, meaning space. So chidakash is the mind space. Fourth and fifth chakra activity, what we call love and wisdom. What is it? Well, it's a fashioning of chidakash into the state of receptivity and into the state of reflectivity. You'll never hear this anywhere else on earth, my brothers. So chittakash into the condition of receptivity is fourth chakra love, and chittakash fashioned into a state of reflectivity, which includes receptivity, receptive reflective, that's wisdom, that's fifth chakra activity. Attachment to that process is so-called passion for form, or attachment to fine material experience. Then, passion for what is formless, meaning attachment to formless experience, is attachment to the higher jhanas. The higher jhanas, 5, 6, 7, 8, at least, some systems go to 9. 5, 6, 7, 8 is the experience of the infinity of space, infinity of consciousness, experience of nothingness, and then neither perception or non-perception. These are four higher jhanas, formless jhanas, associated with sixth and seventh dimensional experience, it seems to me, which is attachment to the formless realms, or formless realm experience, or activity of sixth and seventh chakra. Sixth, seventh chakra doesn't really have activity, but certainly attachment to sixth chakra activity is attachment to the experience of infinite space, and passion for, or attachment to, or fashioning of the experience of infinite self, infinite consciousness. So you see, it's not infinite self, it's actually infinite consciousness. So while fourth and fifth dimensions and fourth and fifth chakras are very much, you know, love and wisdom, right? The functions of chittakash, the functions of consciousness, consciousness field as reception, 4. Consciousness field as reception, reflection, 5. 6, 7, 6 chakra, 7th chakra activity, or 6th dimension, 7th dimension experience, is more associated with vijnana or consciousness itself. Not the functions of consciousness, but the nature of consciousness. The experience of consciousness as formless realms. The nature of consciousness itself is the formless realms. And the fifth jhana, then, is infinity of space. Sixth jhana, infinity of consciousness. Seventh jhana, experience of nothingness or realm of nothingness. And then eighth is neither perception nor non-perception. These jhanas are conditions of sixth density, most likely. Seventh density could be called nothingness. You know, maybe seventh density is, you know, what? Nothingness and neither perception nor non-perception? I don't know. But certainly, the four higher jhanas, formless jhanas, are conditions of consciousness associated with sixth density and seven, six and or seven. And so passion for what is formless means attachment to activity of sixth chakra. Attachment to the fashioning of experience based in activity of sixth and seventh chakra. And so we're talking about fashion, the end of fashioning, right? Passion for form or passion for formless or attachment to fourth and fifth chakra activity and attachment to sixth and seventh chakra activity, that attachment generates fashioning, meaning changes in consciousness. It's actually the establishment of consciousness itself. And when these two fetter, when the last five fetters go, there's no more arising of consciousness at all. So while passion for form, associated with form realms and fourth and fifth density, and fourth and fifth chakra activity, could be considered attachment to modifications of consciousness. Consciousness or mind field as reception, and then consciousness or mind field as reception reflection, fourth and fifth chakras. The next fetter, passion for the formless, is attachment to aspects of identification with consciousness itself. Attachment to consciousness as an apparently external object. The fashioning of consciousness. Attachment to the modifications of the fashioning of consciousness. Okay? Attachment to differentiations of consciousness itself, or modifications of consciousness, that are the higher jhanas, like experience of infinite space, the experience of infinite consciousness, the experience of nothingness, the experience of neither perception nor non-perception. These represent fashioned modifications of consciousness itself, not even the functions of mind, but actually the functions of spirit. So fourth and fifth density is really functions of mind, and sixth and seventh density, or sixth and seventh chakra, are really differentiations of consciousness itself, as far as I see. And the basis for all that activity or attachment is the last three, conceit and restlessness and ignorance. It's really ignorance giving rise to conceit and restlessness, which gives rise naturally to attachment to spirit complex activity and mind complex activity. So the formless could be called the fashioning of spirit complex, or differentiations or activity of spirit complex. And form is basically the activity of mind complex. And that you see, it's not just attachment to, it's actually fashioning of. So you see how subtle. And those attachments or grasping at mind function and spirit complex activity or consciousness differentiation rest on conceit and restlessness. And conceit and restlessness are inevitable given avidya, or ignorance. And restlessness is really some kind of non-perfect harmonization of the polarity of intelligent energy itself, love and light itself, right? Love, intelligent energy is love, light, light, love. Those two principles, second principle, third principle of law of love, law of light, law of free will, law of love, law of light. The duality or polarity intrinsic to intelligent energy has to be the perpetuation of instability in intelligent energy itself, which is consciousness, actually. That has to be quelled before one becomes an arahant. And of course, when that is quelled, also what's quelled is ahamkara, or conceit, or I-making, or any kind of identification process of mind. Meaning, consciousness doesn't even generate the mind that identifies or differentiates. And one is free from all that. And that's arahant. So that's a pretty big piece of work, I'd say. Yeah, no, I agree. We don't know. I mean, many of us, some of us, have had sotapanna in the past life, or know what sotapanna is. And so can you say, where we are? But that's just, to me, all of that stuff is unimportant. Because the point is, if you want it faster, if you're in a hurry to achieve complete perfect enlightenment or sotapanna, you have to sit more, and you have to surrender more in the sitting, and you have to basically go through the terror of non-thinking. You basically have to go through whatever levels of fear are associated with progressive non-grasping or surrendering to sati, to mindfulness, watching, 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 no matter what comes up, no matter what comes up. I don't care about mind. I don't care about the mind arising, body, any arising of sensation or perceptions or conceivings or strange paranormal events. I just don't care. I don't care. I'm going to stay with the object of concentration until it is finished. And that attitude, is going straight. And what happens, happens. So if you really want it, meditate as much as possible. But don't become crazy, don't become imbalanced. I mean, when I was in the temple in upstate New York, maybe I told this story before, there was a woman who came in her early 20s. She was like anorexic, bulimic something, eating disorder type somebody. And she could sit in the cold zendo without all the clothing, because she was either high metabolism or she was very strange. But she was the most strong sitting person there in a way. She had the most strong, her zazen was the strongest. But she was actually very psychologically damaged. So she had this ideal of, the ascetic Japanese Rinzai monk. And she was a mess. She couldn't talk well. She was full of complexes. She ate the least. She was the most austere. She ate the least. She slept the least. She wore the least clothing. She sat the most straight. She could sit for the longest time. And she was very sick mentally. And she ended up leaving after a certain period of time. So, this kind of thing is unhelpful. And balance is critical. But if you really want practice or you really want achievement, do walking meditation everywhere you go. Walking meditation every time you're walking outside, do walking meditation. But don't neglect your body, don't neglect your family, don't neglect your responsibilities, don't neglect money, don't neglect self-body care, don't neglect anything that really is important. And if you do that, if you want to become super monk, and then you neglect those other aspects of life, there will be big problems. And that's not awakening. That's that approach is psychosis or mental damage. So not too tight, not too loose, Gautama said. The integration is Ra's seven-dimensional, seven-chakra perspective with an integration of Buddhist presentation of the four stages of awakening, the 10 fetters, the 8 jhanas, and the 3 realms of desire, form, and formless, and how that relates to virtue or giving and generosity. But the understanding of formless realms and the working of dissolving the 5 higher fetters, it is very interesting that only the Arahant breaks the 5 higher fetters or is free of them, while even the non-returner is not. The non-returner finishes the first 5 fetters and pretty much is free of the roots of desire or grasping and aversion, ill will. Ill will becomes more and more fine, meaning the yogi in samadhi or in a jhana, that they're different. But in let's say in a jhana that feels fear to dissolve or detach further, that fear can be considered ill will. Fear is aversion. I don't want. No. That experience of fear to dissolve further, or to detach further, really. It's really detach. It's not dissolving anything. It's detaching from grasping. There's a fear to further detach and experience further non-differentiation or further dissolution of differentiating thoughts or samskara, the aversion to be free of samskara, the aversion to release the clinging, grasping basis of ahamkara, the aversion to detachment associated with moving to true restlessness. These are very subtle levels of aversion that the word ill will doesn't quite convey, because ill will seems like anger and hatred, but at those levels of mind associated with higher jhanas, formless jhanas, and deeper states of samadhi, which doesn't necessarily go into the formless jhanas. There is the samadhi that is available, a state of mindfulness, but very great peace of mind or spaciousness of chittakash, heart space, heart mind space, spaciousness. There is that experience of that deepening samadhi where aversion or fear as a form of aversion will arise to the prospect of further detaching, further non-grasping, further return to mindfulness rather than grasping on even to bliss or joy or experience of the jhanas, or the formless jhanas, right? The mind is in this formless jhana of experiencing infinite or boundless space or consciousness or nothingness, and doesn't want to leave that. That's aversion or ill will. And that's a fear of further detachment, fear of detaching from the grasping at the formless states of blissful, boundless self or boundless mind. It's really boundless consciousness and boundless spaciousness. One can be attached to those, of course. It's very normal. And that was what Gautama rejected when he rejected the teachers that taught him those formless jhanas who considered that those formless jhanas, or greatly expanded states of consciousness, were the goal, which they're not. They're just other states of consciousness, expanded, high, fine, you know, not even fine material, but formless states of consciousness, or freedom from differentiation, freedom from samskara, yes, but not freedom from consciousness, actually, because there's the consciousness of boundless space, or boundless, or spacious, boundless spaciousness, and the consciousness of this boundless sense of consciousness, the awareness or conceiving of the state of that expansion, or the attachment to non-conceiving or nothingness, is itself not necessarily freedom from the roots of attachment. It's just a temporary suppression or cessation of thought production. Even that is not the goal, because there still may be there's still the arising of dualistic consciousness, or eighth and ninth fetters, that may be still in the beingness, even though the person could experience eighth, seventh jhana nothingness. So anyway, it's all very subtle. But I wouldn't be aiming for arahant. It seems more reasonable to simply aim for sotapanna. But if we keep thinking I want sotapanna, of course one will never get that, and it's not even a getting. It's actually a realization or realization or gnosis, direct knowing, that is the result of a very substantial or significant detaching, which comes naturally with very, very deep samadhi that doesn't go into the formless trances. Yeah, you're welcome. I mean, I think the only people who could see the benefit of this is somebody who's by their meditation or self-reflective seeking to understand, able to conceptualize or differentiate these aspects of process. So it's irrelevant for, most everybody in the world, but it's very relevant for us working to get a clear understanding or clear view of higher levels of the spiritual path, and more subtle working on seven chakras. So it's just not relevant for most people, and I get that now, so that's okay. Right, and we still may have problems, and those problems, the roots of experiencing what we call a problem, the roots were not cut out by the talking. if we still have problems. I mean, there's a difference between pain and suffering in Buddhism also. And pain is considered inevitable, but suffering is optional. Suffering is made by ignorance, but pain is a normal type of sensation, or is a type of sensation that simply may come and go. Now, a more enlightened person like Nityananda or Gautama, they can transmute body sensations that we call pain into what for them is not painful. But that's a magical power, and a power of complete awakening. But in general, there's the dukkha of body sensational pain, or mind pain, which would be the loss of a pleasant state of mind, or the loss of a pleasant formless realm expansion of consciousness state of mind, or change, anatta, anicca, impermanence. The experience of impermanence is itself dukkha, actually, to the mind that's still grasping or still conceiving of states that can come and go. So it's not a... If somebody shouts at us, we may have a very peaceful mind, but the body will still feel you know, an assault from the vibratory experience or the vibratory influence of the sound and then the meaning. But even that can be transmuted depending, you know, at higher levels of development. So, but going back to our daily life after such high talking, it's still very important or critical to be willing to turn attention to the problem rather than hate the problem because we've fallen out of some kind of happy state associated with talking about high metaphysics. So, but disharmony, you know, is sort of inevitable until we're free of restlessness. So, anyway, thanks for being here. It was deep and valuable for me, and I hope for you. Take good care. See you next time, and good night.